I'd just like to add a little bit to this idea of dependent arising here.
So remember we said that things were empty of independent existence because they are dependent arisings. And things are dependent arisings in these three ways. They depend on causes, conditions, parts, and imputation and labelling, conception, designation. What I'd like to do briefly now is go back to look at causes and conditions and parts and try to understand them in a little bit deeper level than we previously understood, based on this idea here. So this is a timeline, this is a seed, and this is the sprout that it produces. So we say that the sprout or plant exists depending on causes and conditions. So the underlying cause, the substantial cause, of course, is the seed. The conditions are the soil, sunlight, water, and so forth. So those causes and conditions mean that that seed will then eventually produce the sprout. The question is, now, we accept that things exist independently, independent of us. If that's the case, then at what point does the seed become the plant? And again, if they exist independent of us, it should be a fixed, obvious point, because it's got nothing to do with us, because it exists, they exist independent of us. So at what point does the seed become the plant? Who can tell me?
When it has the necessary conditions and causes.
Which point? Tell me. Where is the seed turning into the plant?
The penultimate. When it sprouts for the first time.
This.
The whole time. Before that.
This. So, everyone agrees that this is a plant and not a seed? No. Maybe not. So remember, we accept and believe that things exist independently. If that is really the case, then it shouldn't be up to us at what point the seed becomes a plant. It should be at a fixed, predetermined point. But if we look at this situation, what we can understand is at what point does the seed become the plant? We determine that. Because the point at where the seed becomes the plant is the point at which this configuration of data stops looking like our concept of seed and starts looking like our concept of plant. And our concepts of seed and plant are a little bit different. So for some of us, it would be here. For some of us, here. Some of us, here. We determine when the seed becomes the plant. We bring the plant into existence through our conception. Another point related to that is we say that the seed and plant are in a cause and effect relationship. And if two things are in a cause and effect relationship, by definition they cannot exist at the same time. The question here is, does the seed cease to exist before the plant comes into existence? So again, think about it. Does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? There can only be two answers, yes or no. Which is it? No. The seed and plant are in a cause and effect relationship. Does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? There can only be two answers, yes or no. Which is it?
No.
That means the seed exists at the same time as the plant. By definition, that is illogical. You cannot have two things existing at the same time if they're in a cause and effect relationship. So no is illogical. If you say yes, then you say the seed has ceased to exist. Where does the plant come from if the seed has stopped existing?
It has the potential to bring out the plant.
We're not talking about potential. We're talking about the seed. So the seed has ceased to exist. Where does the plant come from? But the seed's gone. We say the seed has stopped existing. Now we're talking at the point. We have to be very logical here. Yeah. So the seed produces the plant. They're in a cause and effect relationship. Does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? Logically, there can be only two options, yes or no. If we say no, it means that the seed exists at the same time as the plant. That's impossible. If two things in a cause and effect relationship, they cannot exist at the same time. So no is illogical. But then if we say yes, then the seed has ceased to exist. Where is the plant coming from? Yes is illogical. Both yes and no are illogical, which means our common sense idea of cause and effect relationship based on independent existence is completely illogical. It cannot work. Cannot work. Nagarjuna, in his classic text in the 2nd century, Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way, the Mula Majjhimika Karika, has 27 chapters of these sorts of arguments. Saying, you believe in independent existence? What about cause and result? What about object and action, agent and action? What about this and that, fire and fuel? How do they work? And then when we look at them logically, based on independent existence, they're just completely nonsensical. They cannot work. So the problem is that we are, what we can really understand here is that there is a seamless flow of change. But what we do by making things independently existence, we turn them into discrete objects. If you turn things into discrete objects, you have a big problem. Nothing works anymore. Illogical. The same thing. We talk about moments of time. If we have a discrete moment of time, time becomes illogical. It cannot work. So we can understand here that if we understand that this is a seamless flow and there are no discrete things turning into other things, then there's no problem. We don't have this logical absurdity. And so this is an implication of that things are merely labeled. That the seed becomes a plant, all we do is we just change the label. There's no problem. No problem there at all. Another point here is we say that the plant exists depending on the cause and condition. So the result exists depending on the cause. This view is saying also the cause depends on the result. How does the cause depend on the result? So I didn't hear what you said. Exactly. You can only call this a cause if you have the idea that it potentially could produce a result. Whether or not it does is irrelevant. You can only call it a seed if you have the idea that it could potentially produce a plant. You can't have cause or seed without the idea, result, or plant. Whether or not it happens, that's irrelevant. So this is cause and conditions. What I'd like to do now is a little bit more look at parts. This pen exists depending on its parts. But is there a pen to be found here amongst the bases? Because normally we say the pen is the collection of the parts. This is a pen. But is there a pen to be found here anywhere? Is this a pen? No. Is this a pen? No. Is this cube a pen? No. Is this plastic tube a pen? No. Is the ink inside a pen? No. Is the metal ball on the end a pen? No. Is the other bit of plastic here a pen? No. Where is the pen? Then people go, oh, that's easy. It's the collection of that stuff. The pen is the collection. Okay? There's the collection. Is that a pen? Oh, no. It has to be in a certain shape. Okay, you have to tell me when the pen comes into existence. Anybody? No.
I'm labeling it almost dependent.
Okay, you have to don't tell me when it comes into existence. Now, what about that? Oh, we don't need it. It was part of the pen before, but now it's not. What's going on? So, what we can understand again from this example is we determine when the pen comes into existence. And that is when this configuration of data closely enough resembles our concept of pen. And our concepts usually have at least two parts, appearance and functionality. So when this appears closely enough to our concept of pen, and it seems to function according to our concept of pen, then there's a pen, not before. If the pen existed from its own side, if this was a pen from its own side, it would mean that a caveman would walk in the door and would see pen and would start writing with it. Caveman walked in, probably see some sort of weapon to stab some animal with. If a dog came into the room, probably see some sort of chewing stick. And if a tiny ant came here, they may see some sort of home, somewhere to live. So is this a pen, a weapon, a chewing stick, or a home? It's all and none of those. It's none of those from its own side, it's all of those from the side of the observer. So it's merely labelled, merely imputed. Also, here, we say that the pen exists depending on its parts. In other words, the whole exists depending on its parts. But this view is also saying the part depends on the whole. Again, you can only call this a part of a pen if you have the idea pen. Whether or not the pen exists is irrelevant. But you can only call it a part if you have the idea whole. So part depends on whole as well. And so here we have something that can help us to understand emptiness. Normally we say this is a pen, or we say the pen is the collection of the parts. But this view is saying that's false. This view is saying the pen exists depending on its parts. The pen is merely labelled depending on its parts. So if we can understand those two statements are not saying the same thing, we're beginning to understand something about emptiness. So the two statements are, the pen is the collection of the parts, or the pen is merely labelled or exists depending on the collection of the parts. Another point here is, we have our old friend cognitive fusion working here. Because we have the basis, which is a collection of stuff, and we have the label, pen. And so, of course, we need to correctly apply the label pen to the basis. So a pen is something that we're labelling upon depending on this basis. But what we do, of course, is we fuse the label to the basis. This is a pen. That's where the problem starts. This is not a pen. A pen is something merely labelled depending on this collection of stuff. So again, our language, unfortunately, leads us in the way of grasping onto things existing independently because of using that way of speaking. So this is how we are to understand dependent arising. Any questions on that before I move on? Yes. Oh, sorry, I can't hear you. You have to speak up. Nothing. So, likewise, you can only call this a basis of pen if you have the idea pen. You can only have the basis of something if you have something. Otherwise, what does basis mean?
Yeah.
You could, but it would be irrational, because remember, this labelling is to help us make sense and meaning out of the world. So of course you could label all sorts of things on here, but it wouldn't be meaningful or useful. And we could label pen on this. Sure, we can do that, but is that practical or useful? No. Yeah, we can hallucinate that there's a pen in the air here and say, "There, look, there's a pen." Of course we can do that, but it's not useful.
Side,
So what he is saying is that if you say that the base does not exist from its own side,
correct.
Then you can't think about nihilism.
Correct, and that's why even many modern day philosophers say Nagarjuna is a nihilist, because they don't appreciate the view of emptiness. Because this view of emptiness is so subtle, we are so far in the other extreme that when we look at the view of emptiness, one of the most common initial reactions is, oh, emptiness means nothing exists. Exactly. That's the difficult point of this view. That's why the Buddha didn't teach this to the mass public. Because most people, many people would fall to the extreme of nihilism, saying that, oh, what you're saying, Buddha or Nagarjuna, that's nihilism. Exactly. That's why...
Did Buddha teach it, or did the commentators who followed Buddha?
No, the Buddha taught it. He taught it in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, you know, like Heart Sutra and so forth. The, you know, 100,000 stanzas, perfection, wisdom, all, many sutras, many perfection, wisdom sutras. Okay. So, what we're saying then is that, again, when we look out on the world, to make sense of that, we have to draw these lines and create objects to make sense or meaning. But these objects, of course, we create them, so they are merely labelled. They're not existing there independent of us as separate, discrete things. But that's what we believe. So what we do really is we turn our lines that we draw into hard boundaries. We believe that the world is already divided up into many separate, discrete things. But then you may ask, well, what's the problem with that? What's the problem with seeing the world already divided up into separate, discrete things? And to answer that, I'd like now to, in your handout, have a look at the front sheet, Suffering and Its Causes. So, as we said previously, was that when we look out on the world, everything appears to us as if it exists independent of us. And this view is saying that these appearances are deceiving us, that things are not existing as they appear. And that sometimes is described as this mistaken dualistic appearance, meaning things are appearing to be, there appears to be this subject-object duality, that things appear to exist independent of us. So this is how things are appearing to us all the time. And we have what's called seed of ignorance. So here, ignorance is this grasping onto independent me, independent world. Seed of ignorance is the habit of that. We have the habit of grasping onto independent me, independent world. We've had that habit since we were born, and according to Buddhism, way before that. Now, because we have that habit of grasping, and everything appears to us in this mistaken way, we never question these appearances. Because if we ask anyone else, everyone else will say, yes, this appears to exist independent of me as well. So there's no reason to question these appearances, because we've only seen things in this way. So because we have that habit of grasping, and we have that appearance, we instinctively grasp onto it. Which leads to step two, ignorance. So here we are simply automatically grasping, yes, there's a me here, a world there, independent. Now, every time we experience something, one mental factor that's always present is the mental factor of feeling. And
And here is another classic example where terminology can create a lot of confusion. Normally in English, when we see the word feeling, we usually mean emotions. You know, what are you feeling? What emotions do you have? In Buddhism, the word feeling does not mean emotion. It's a translation of the Sanskrit word vedana. And feeling is a mental factor that simply experiences things as either being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So every time we experience something, we have this mental factor and we experience everything as either being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Of course, neutral means just neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So let's say, for example, that I'm looking at this laptop here. It appears to exist completely independent of me. I have the habit of believing that. I just accept that. Yes, there is a laptop there independent of me. And let's say when I'm looking at this laptop, I'm having a very pleasant experience because I like the form of it. You know, it looks very nice. So I'm having a very pleasant experience. That pleasant experience, together with the belief that this laptop is existing independent of me, will lead to the third step. Which is a misconception. Because I'm having a pleasant experience. That laptop seems to exist independent of me. Therefore, I will naturally assume there must be some attractive quality there that's causing my pleasant feeling. So I'll see this laptop is inherently attractive. Or, alternatively, if I'm having an unpleasant experience when I'm seeing this laptop, together with the belief that that laptop is independent of me, I will naturally assume, of course, there must be some unattractive qualities there that's causing my unpleasant feeling. So I'll see this as inherently unattractive. Or if I'm having a neutral feeling, then of course, there must be inherently neutral qualities in that object. And once I get to the third step here, then the fourth step easily follows. In that, let's say again, I'm looking at this laptop, I'm having a pleasant experience, I'm seeing this as inherently attractive. I like pleasant experiences. I want pleasant experiences. That laptop seems to be causing my pleasant experience. I want that laptop attachment. Or alternatively, if I'm having an unpleasant experience, I don't like unpleasant experiences. That laptop seems to be causing my unpleasant experience. Get it out of here. Aversion. Or if I'm having a neutral experience, that will simply reinforce my belief that that laptop is existing independent of me, meaning reinforcing ignorance. Generally here, instead of using the word ignorance, they use the word confusion, which is just another name for ignorance. And of course, this confusion is not, is this a laptop or not? It's confused about how it exists. It's believing that it's existing independently. So based on our attachment aversion or confusion, based on our experiences, this is what is driving our behavior. Our actions. And within Buddhism, of course, every action we do with a motivation has a result, a consequence. and the result is our experiences. So collectively, of course, our experiences, the Buddha used the word dukkha to describe those. So this is how we are stuck in this state of dukkha because of our ignorance, our distorted view of reality, our grasping onto independent me, independent objective world. Any questions about any of this?
So do all actions lead to dukkha?
All actions with intention, with motivation, yes.
How do you explain that pleasant experiences might lead to good actions? Only pleasant experiences lead to good actions.
Whoa, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that. I mean, you know, if we're having a pleasant experience and someone interferes with that, usually that doesn't lead to a good action.
So,
right.
How does that become a good action?
What is a good action?
A good action that for the benefit of others?
Yeah, sure. So remember, dukkha includes both our unpleasant, our painful experiences, our pleasant experiences, and neutral experiences. So if we do, out of this state of ignorance, if we do a virtuous action, then we get a happiness result, which of course is still dukkha. Isn't it? Isn't it? Isn't dukkha the overall human condition? So dukkha is describing both our suffering experiences and our happiness experiences, and underlying that, the all-pervasive dukkha. So dukkha includes all of our experiences. So if they are happiness experiences, they're coming from virtuous actions. If they're suffering experiences, coming from non-virtuous actions.
So here at this stage, you bring in the Four Noble Truths. At this stage, you can bring in the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah, this is all Four Noble Truths. In fact, if we look at this, this is the first noble truth, yeah? Truth? This is the first noble truth, truth of dukkha. Second noble truth, what is the Buddha saying is the second noble truth? The two things. Mental afflictions and actions. Mental afflictions, here. Actions, here. So this is second noble truth. Second noble truth, leading to first noble truth. Very good. Yeah, question? Yes. Oh, no, you have a question.
Why are you labeling everything as dukkha?
Because the Buddha used the word dukkha to describe the human experience, overall human experience. Right. Oh, I think the problem here is, in modern Hindi, dukkha somehow means sorrow or sadness. That's not the meaning, the original Sanskrit meaning. It's changed. It's changed in meaning.
No, Sanskrit also dukkha means suffering.
Well, I think it's not quite, because one way to translate this is unsatisfactory.
All right, why is happiness unsatisfactory then?
Because it doesn't last. It changes.
No, but
the reason we don't enjoy it is because we anticipate that it's not going to last, and then we get a bit agitated.
No, that's what your Buddhist keeps telling us.
If you can.
You
no. So. Oh, absolutely not. No. What I said actually earlier is exactly the opposite. What I said earlier was, according to Buddhism, we should enjoy our pleasures in life as much as possible without grasping and clinging to them. It's the grasping and clinging to them that creates suffering. And so if we realize dukkha and we have a pleasant experience, we would enjoy it fully, realizing that it's a pleasant experience, but it's not going to fully satisfy us. It's not going to last. And then we can enjoy it much more. So as a good Buddhist, we should be enjoying our pleasant experiences more than we normally do. As a good Buddhist, we should be understanding that we're trying to also go beyond that to genuine happiness, to try to get to a state whereby we're not having to rely on some sort of pleasant stimulus
to have a sense of well-being. That's what we're striving for, that goal. Because as long as our happiness and well-being is at the mercy of conditions, we're in trouble. We can't control them. But if we can use our good conditions to go beyond that, to get to a state of well-being and happiness that does not depend on any particular stimulus, that's what we're striving for, I hope. Yeah?
What is a neutral feeling because of confusion? What is a neutral feeling because of the confusion?
Because neutral feeling, it just means it's sort of just reinforcing. Because remember, with all of this, we're seeing things as independently existent. So a neutral feeling probably is not going to directly lead to this, but with a neutral feeling, we'll simply be continuing to grasp on it as independent. So remember, confusion here doesn't mean what is this thing. This is equals ignorance. So here, I mean ignorance. This is what the word... But what you find is in this context, the three, usually they tend to use the word confusion. But it can be confusing. Because when people see that, they go, well, does that mean we don't understand what that thing is? No. This confusion is about how that thing exists. And it's just another word for ignorance. It just means that we are grasping onto it as existing independently. So neutral feelings directly don't tend to immediately get us into too much trouble with these, but they will still reinforce our sense that that thing is actually independent of me. And that's what this is to sort of highlight, that's all.
By confusion, sorry, do you mean wrong view in that way?
Wrong view, we can have a wrong view about many things. One wrong view is the wrong view of the nature of reality, so that wrong view. Yeah. Wrong view in terms of misunderstanding nature of reality. One of the wrong views often talked about is this view of the appropriated aggregates, which is this grasping onto self. So that wrong view, yes, here, but we can have wrong view about all sorts of things, other things, but not that.
That's so judgmental, isn't it? That's very judgmental.
What's judgmental?
By labeling something as wrong view.
But that's through direct experience.
What's the question? Why not tech savvy? I'm not tech savvy.
You're not? What's wrong?
Tech savvy.
Tech savvy, yeah.
So, I will label your computer as causing confusion.
As causing confusion? What do you mean?
Causing confusion for me.
Because you don't understand what it is.
Yes.
That's okay, so.
So that's why you're labeling it as a wrong view.
But that sort of confusion is not this. Not knowing whether this is a laptop or not, it's got nothing to do with this.
Well, that's
okay. You can operate it. But that's got nothing to do with what we're talking about here. Here we're talking about not understanding how it exists. Whether or not we know what to do with it is a completely other concern. So here we're only talking about how that thing exists, not whether or not we know what it is or how to use it. That's other issue. That's not what we're really talking about here. Well, I'm not dissociating them. What I'm saying is that this process is a process from in terms of misunderstanding how things exist. This is the process from that. Associated with that, of course, is all the things that you've mentioned. Absolutely. But those things are not an integral part of this process. That's all. Because this process is only to show how we are stuck in the state of dukkha through our misunderstanding of the nature of reality.
Why have you
said
that it's perceived as ignorance and ignorance in step one
and two? Why, what, sorry?
So in step one, you
label
it as perceived as ignorance.
Correct.
And second step, you call it the activity.
Yeah. So this is dormant. This is dormant, and this is manifest. And then, of course, every time it manifests, it is sort of a very vicious loop. Yeah.
What is this
dualistic?
Yeah. How does that just make appearance?
Just 1 minute, sorry.
Same thing. The first one, the ignorance and the mistaken dualistic reality. What is the difference
Okay.
between the two?
Okay.
There's one more thing to add from your diagram, so let's look at that. So when we have this ignorance, when we're grasping onto independent me, independent world, that reinforces our habit of grasping. But also there's another side effect of ignorance. And that's called latency of ignorance. Another word for latency is stain. So to understand what this stain or latency is, often in the text they sort of make an analogy. They say, imagine you have a bowl and you have a clove of garlic. And you put the garlic in the bowl. Then even if you take the garlic out, the bowl is stained by the smell of the garlic. Likewise, by putting ignorance or having ignorance in our mind, that ignorance stains our mind like that. That stain, what does that do? What it does is that when we come into contact with an object, that object appears to us in a mistaken dualistic way, meaning that this stain of ignorance is like a filter in our mind. It means we're looking out on the world through this filter or stain. That's why objects appear to us in this mistaken dualistic way. So what this view is saying here is that if we want to overcome dukkha, if we want to achieve nirvana, we have to go back and eliminate ignorance. But if we've achieved nirvana, we still have this. So in our heart, someone's achieved nirvana, the world still appears to exist independent of them. But because they've realized emptiness, they understand that this appearance is deceiving them. They never buy into it. So it never causes them a problem. If we want to get from nirvana to enlightenment, we need to get rid of this. So from nirvana to enlightenment, we wipe out these stains and thereby wipe out this mistaken dualistic appearance. And if we can do this, this is much more difficult than getting rid of this. If we can get rid of this, we get rid of this, we achieve enlightenment. So this here, as we see in the chart, is called the cognitive obscurations. That obscurations that are stopping us from achieving enlightenment. Whereas this, ignorance and the mental afflictions, are what's called the afflictive obscurations, the mental afflictions that are stopping us from achieving the goal of nirvana. Okay? Any questions? Yeah.
Isn't the mistaken dualistic appearance, isn't that ignorance?
No. No, because an arhat has this and has no ignorance. The mistaken dualistic appearance is coming because of the stains of ignorance. That is the cause of the mistaken dualistic appearance.
What exactly do you mean by mistaken dualistic appearance?
Things appear to exist independent of us. So for us, there appears to be subject-object duality. Me, world. That's dualistic. Yeah? And this view is saying that this appearance is deceiving us. That things are not existing in this dualistic way. Hence, that appearance is mistaken. It's deceiving us. That's what it means.
How would you give a counter argument to that? You and I are there. Is this a dualistic appearance? You and I? You're there and I'm here?
There appears to be a me here and a you there. You appear to me to exist independent of me. But what this view is saying is if we investigate this in a logical way, we'll come to realize that that's deceiving us. To help understand that, we can ask a question. Is this big?
Is it?
Is it big?
Big. Not
big. It's small?
Relative.
Exactly. You can only have big relative to small. You can't have big and small, can you? Likewise, you can't have up without down, in without out. Likewise, you can't have me without not me. You can't have subject without object. You can't have experiencer without experienced. So
You can't have me without not me. That me, not me, could be the world or you. So you can't have me without you. That's dependency. So that's what we're talking about here. That it appears as if there is, to us, there appears as if it's big and small. But that's mistaken. That if we think about it, we'll understand that big and small are codependent. Likewise, me and not me, or me and the world, or me and you, are codependent. But it appears as if that's not the case. It appears there is a me here and a you there. But I'm going to talk more about that in the session after lunch.
So that's the mistake. So what is the ignorance?
Is grasping onto that mistaken appearance. So we have that mistaken appearance. It's up to us whether we accept that or not. If we accept it and grasp onto it, that's ignorance. Now, related to this, oh, before I go on, any more questions about this chart? Yeah.
Ignorance. That one is
sorry?
Ignorance. It's
somewhat
avoiding something.
Not here.
So here, what is the
picture? Here, and in the text, it really goes into a lot of detail here. Here, the word ignorance is in Tibetan, ma rikpa, or avidya in Sanskrit. It means not knowing, not knowing. But it's more than not just not understanding, it's actively misunderstanding. So we can say, so ignorance here is simply not knowing. It's an active misknowing, wrong knowing, a misunderstanding. So ignorance here is an active misunderstanding of the nature of reality.
So, then he said, it's not knowing which is causing the problem. He said, knowing wrongly is the one.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we have this mistaken appearance, and then we just grasp onto it. That's what this ignorance is. It's grasping onto, yes, there is a me here and a world there. That's false. That's wrong. That grasping. So it's an active grasping. Of course, this is not intellectual. It's instinctive.
Yeah, but then there's this dualistic thing. You said dualistic. There's this object. The object is that to us. That object is that the kind of the experience that is close to us, and the reality of the object itself. The reality of the object is man hidden down there. And we just kind of, observers, only the appearance, that object forms.
Right. The reason we have this is because of this. The cause of the mistaken dualistic appearance is these stains in our mind. These stains in our mind is like a filter. It's the analogy sometimes I use here is it's like if we wear green sunglasses, we look out on the world, everything appears green. And if we've been wearing green sunglasses since we were born, and then someone comes to us and says, hey, not everything's green, you'll go, you're crazy, look, everything's green. No, because we've never seen anything else. So that's the same here, is these stains are causing objects to appear in the mistaken dualistic way. And we've only ever seen things in this way. So if someone tells us, no, things are not like that, we'll go, you're crazy, look. But if what this view is saying is if we investigate this in a very methodical, logical way, we'll come to realize that actually these appearances are deceiving us. It's like, and realizing emptiness is like taking the green sunglasses off and go, wow, actually things are not as I thought. But again, we need to come to realize emptiness to have that understanding fully. Okay. Now,
is Wallace a Buddhist?
Alan Wallace, yes, he's been a Buddhist for 40 years. He's for the first 20 years he was following the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism, and for the last 20 years he's been following the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism. Now, as I think one or two people have brought up already, this related to this next topic, is this topic of the two extremes. And the two extremes are, and this is the two extremes, of course, in terms of our philosophical view. I mean, in Buddhism, we can talk about two extremes in a number of contexts. Of course, in the shamatha practice, the two extremes are laxity, dullness, and distraction, you know. So here we're talking about a philosophical view. The extreme of existence is generally where we are now. So the extreme of existence is grasping on to the fact that things exist independently. So the extreme of existence is believing in independent existence. Now, when, as I mentioned here, if we really investigate this ourselves in the world, we'll come to see that things are not existing independently. And so we'll come to realize that things are lacking independent existence. So to help us to overcome this extreme, of course, the antidote is to realize this, that things lack independent existence. This is the realization of emptiness. But, as I mentioned once or twice already, for us, there just seems to be two possibilities now. Either there is a solid independent me and a solid independent world, or there's no me and no world. We've never entertained any other possibility. So, when we start to investigate the nature of reality and come to realize emptiness, one of the first experiences is that we simply flip to the other extreme of non-existence or nihilism. Because by undermining this real functioning world that seems to exist independent of us, it seems like we're undermining the very existence of the world and the very existence of ourselves. But what we need to remember, of course, is what we are undermining is independent existence. We're not undermining existence. And so if we have a correct understanding of emptiness, then rather than falling to the extreme of nihilism, we will understand that emptiness implies that actually things are dependently existent. And so if we can understand that, the fact that things are dependent arisings, that can help us to avoid falling to the extreme of nihilism. And again, what we often find in the beginning phases of this practice is that when people start to investigate the nature of reality and start to investigate this idea of emptiness, then often what people would say is things like, well, if everything's empty, then nothing can work, nothing functions, nothing really exists. So that's falling to the extreme of nihilism. And also, so this is the sort of initial phase of the practice. Often what happens is people think that because things are empty, they don't really work, they don't really exist, and they fall to extreme nihilism. If we continue to work on that philosophical view, particularly really trying to understand the idea of dependent arisings, then the next stage, people will go,
okay, you know, despite the fact that things are empty, they sort of work, okay. But then the real measure of having a good understanding of emptiness is the having the thought that because things are empty, they can function. And because things function, they must be empty of independent existence. That is a sign that our emptiness practice is really starting to progress and we're coming to a correct view of emptiness. For example, if this glass exists from its own side, if it had a unique nature, inherent nature of being a glass, then it couldn't change. We couldn't create it, we couldn't destroy it, it couldn't function. But because this is not a glass from its own side, it does not have a unique inherent nature of being a glass, therefore it can change. You can create it, it can be destroyed, it can function, it can do something. So therefore this is the sort of understanding that is very helpful for us to avoid falling to the extreme of nihilism. And there's a very nice quote regarding this from Nagarjuna, from his Mula Majjhimika Karika, who he says, that which arises dependently and relatedly is explained as being empty, and that which is empty is dependently designated. This is the middle way path. So we're trying to find that middle way between these two extremes. And so what we will come to appreciate is that emptiness and dependent arising, or a functioning world, are not contradictory. Now they appear to contradictory to us. There either is this functioning world, or things are empty and they don't exist. But the real measure is to understand that emptiness and dependent arising, functioning world, are two sides of a single coin. That emptiness means dependent arising means emptiness. And with this investigation into emptiness, because it's such a subtle topic, often we find analogies used in the text to help us better understand what do we mean by emptiness. And there are many analogies used in the text. One that I particularly like is the analogy of a dream. I find it very helpful. So, in a dream, of course, when we're dreaming, there appears to be a dream me and there appears to be an independent dream world out there. And so, in the dream, if we have experienced something unpleasant or pleasant in the dream, we will react. You know, unpleasant, we may react with a lot of fear and anxiety and try and run away. Something pleasant in the dream, we'll have a lot of craving and so forth to it. But if within the dream, if suddenly we realise we're dreaming without waking up, so this is of course what's called lucid dreaming, which is not that difficult to cultivate, to develop. If in the middle of the dream we suddenly realise, hang on, this is a dream, then there still will appear to be an independent dream me, there will still appear to be an independent dream world out there, but because we're lucid now, we'll realise that these appearances are deceiving us. There is no independent dream me, there is no independent dream world, this is all a product of the mind. Which means if we're lucid in the dream and we are faced with some unpleasant situation in the dream, it would become quite difficult to react to that in a negative way. And also if something pleasant comes up in the dream, it would become quite difficult to react with a craving and attachment. And we would enjoy the dream a hell of a lot more. So this view of emptiness is saying that things are like a dream. Meaning that like a dream, in our daily world, in our waking life, there appears to be an independent me here, there appears to be an independent world out there. And then based on that, when we experience pleasant and unpleasant things, then of course we react with a craving and attachment to the pleasant ones, aversion, maybe hostility, anger and hatred to the unpleasant experiences. But if we become lucid in our waking state, if we wake up from our sleep of ignorance through realizing emptiness, then there still will appear to be an independent me and an independent world out there. But because we've realized emptiness, we have directly realized that these appearances are deceiving us, just like in a lucid dream. And thereby, because of that, it would become very difficult in our daily life to react to unpleasant things with aversion, hostility, anger, hatred, and it would become very difficult to react to pleasant experiences with craving and attachment and so forth. And we would enjoy our waking life a hell of a lot more and suffer a lot less. So this is an analogy of the dream, which I think can be very helpful to understand this view of emptiness and dependent arising. And therefore, also, I think, because to cultivate, develop lucid dreaming is not that difficult, it can be quite helpful to develop lucid dreaming for that reason. And often, people who develop lucid dreaming, one of the common experiences they have when they first develop it is that they're completely amazed at how their mind could create such a vivid, real, supposedly independent reality. So I think lucid dreaming can be something useful to help us in the spiritual path. And of course, in Tibetan Buddhism, at the very high levels of practice, then not only is there techniques such as lucid dreaming or dream yoga, but also lucid sleep and sleep yoga and so forth, where we can use those states as part of our meditative practice. But that's quite a high level of practice in the Tibetan Buddhist system. Any questions?
Is lucid dreaming in the Tibetan tradition too?
Yeah, sure. I mean, generally you'll find it comes in the context of what's called dream yoga. So, of course, within the Tibetan system, when there's dream yoga and sleep yoga, it's for a very sort of exalted purpose. I mean, lucid dreaming, you know, we can just develop it and have a bit of fun, you know. But at the high level, and usually in Tibetan Buddhism, it only comes really within Tantra, and in a very high level of Tantric practice, in fact. And they would use that for a number of reasons. One, to prepare for time of death. Secondly, to within lucid dreaming and so forth, and dream yoga and so forth, use that state to meditate and realize emptiness and so forth. There are a number of things that they can do there.
In lucid dreaming, because you realize that this is a dream, is it possible to change
the dream state? Yeah. So, of course, the rules in the waking state and the dream state are not equal. So we're not saying that the waking state is equivalent to the dream state. So we need to be careful here that the analogy is that things are like a dream. We're not saying things are a dream or an illusion. Then we have some problems. Then there's problems. In all of these analogies, it's always like a dream, like an illusion, like this, like that. How is our reality like these things? Is that in a dream, things do not exist in the way they appear. In an illusion, in a mirage, things are not existing as they appear. Likewise, our daily life, things are not existing as they appear. So that's the limit of the analogy. If we take the analogy too far, we'll go, but in a dream I can change things, and in the waking world I can't. Then we've taken the analogy too far. The analogy is only meant to show that in both cases, things are not as they appear. Things do not exist as they appear. That's all.
How would the Freudian approach of dreaming?
I don't know anything about Freud, sorry. Yeah.
So whether with the dream or in the waking state, so the one that sees that this is a dream.
Yeah.
Is that one also a dependent arising?
Yeah. So far I've been, to slowly introduce this idea of emptiness, dependent arising, I've been using the physical world, you know, we're using laptops and cups and pens and stuff, because it's something tangible and easy. What we're going to do after lunch, and maybe I'll briefly introduce it now actually, is where it comes interesting is when we're focusing on the me, the observer, the agent. So maybe I'll mention a few points on that now before we slowly wrap up the morning session. So, as I said at the start, that when we look out on the world, to make sense of the world, we have to draw these lines around various collections of data to make things into meaningful objects, to make sense. And of course, how we do that line drawing is completely arbitrary, depending on the context and depending on the meaning that we want to get out of it. And we have to do that, otherwise we couldn't function. And this is something that we are continuously learning. I think a newborn baby is very limited in its ability to do any sort of even very, very crude, rudimentary line drawing. But even as an adult, we are continually faced with situations where we're struggling to draw lines, you know. We go into a new situation, a new environment, where we see something we've never seen before. Because actually, in this line drawing, we are pattern matchers. You know, already we have a database of concepts. And so when we see some configuration of data, we're trying to match that to all of our concepts. And often we can make that match. But sometimes we go into a new situation where we have some configuration of data that's completely foreign, doesn't match any of our known concepts in our mind. So then we're sort of scratching our head and going, well, you know, what is this? Is this a single thing? Is it a collection of things? I mean, we're really struggling to make sense out of it. So we are continually trying to improve our capacity to draw lines, to make better and better, more accurate sense of the world. And we have to do that. Now, usually in most of our experiences, the very first line we draw is we draw a line around here. Because we're talking about single experience. Within single experience, there are two aspects. There's the experiencer and the experienced. So if we can't draw a line and distinguish experiencer from experienced, then there's a problem. And I think newborn babies even have difficulty doing that basic level of line drawing. So we draw this line, and we correctly distinguish me or experiencer or whatever label we want to apply, and then from that we distinguish the object, the world, you, and so forth. So that's something we have to do, otherwise we couldn't function. But the problem, like before I mentioned, is that we don't realize that's what we're doing. We believe there's already a separate independent me and an independent world. So we are turning this line into a boundary. We are seeing instinctively that there is a me here and a world there. So we are contracting around the me part of experience and grasping onto this me as if it exists independent of the experience. But as we just briefly saw before, then you can't have big on its own. You can only have big relative to small. They are codependent. Likewise, you can only have up with down, in with out. So like that, of course, you can only have experiencer together with experienced. You can only have subject with object. You can only have me with not me, or me with you, or me with the world, whatever the opposite of the me is. But what we do, of course, is we don't realize that. We grasp onto the me part of the experience, we contract around that, and of course, this is called here self-grasping. Meaning we're grasping onto an independent me, or grasping onto this self, which is an independent me, and that's the source of all of our problems, as we saw in this chart. Because through doing that, then we'll be seeing the world as independent, which means when we experience something in that supposed independent world, pleasant, unpleasant, then we're going to end up with attachment to the pleasant and aversion to the unpleasant. But that self-grasping, which is the root of samsara, that instinctive grasping that there is an independent me, that's exactly like saying this is big. I mean, it just does not make any sense whatsoever. And intellectually, we can sort of appreciate you can only have, you know, experiencer with experience, me with subject with object, and so forth. Intellectually, I think most of us can appreciate that. But again, our behavior is not based on that intellectual understanding. Our behavior is based on this instinctive grasping that actually there is a me here and a world there. And that leads to our mental afflictions and sufferings. So, and very often in our behavior, we have very strong self-grasping. Because very often in our behavior, we have a strong sense of me going there, me saying this, me doing that. There's always this me, 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 me is our main focus. Because with self-grasping, We're seeing ourselves as independent of the world. And with that, it's very easy to go to what's called self-cherishing, which we briefly looked at yesterday in the Tong Len meditation. So self-cherishing here, of course, is this selfish, self-centered attitude. So here we're seeing ourselves as independent of the world. On that basis, it's very easy not only to see ourselves as independent of the world, but the center of the world. Everything revolves around me. My happiness is the most important thing. Everything revolves around me. Me, 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 me. And so this is self-cherishing. So if we have this obsessive self-focus, I'm the most important, then in our behaviour, then we have very strong self-grasping. And therefore, with that self-grasping, of course, we are completely out of sync with reality, because reality is interdependent. But we are seeing ourselves as completely independent of the world. And we're completely out of sync with the reality. Therefore, we are fighting and struggling against reality. And if we fight and struggle against reality, we suffer and lose, and the people around us suffer and lose. But sometimes in our behavior, this self-grasping is not as strong. This often happens in behavior where we are more focused on the activity rather than the me who's doing the activity. For example, you know, in situations where we are absorbed in a good movie on TV, absorbed in reading a good book, absorbed in solving a problem at work. In these occasions, of course, we are more focused on the activity rather than the agent, the me who's doing the activity. So self-grasping is a little bit less, which means we're not fighting against reality as much. We're not as out of sync with reality. And we know from our own experience, in those cases, things seem to flow much better. Time seems to go quite quickly. Why? Because we're not fighting against reality as much as normal. And that we can take to another level. If particularly we develop high level of concentration. So this is the shamatha practice. So through the shamatha practice, one of the beneficial effects of that is we actually reduce our self-grasping. And this can also be highlighted in people who have spent thousands of hours training in their activity. People like professional musicians, professional athletes, have spent thousands of hours, have developed a high level of focus in their activity. So much so that when they actually engage in that activity, you know, they often say things like they're in the zone or the flow state. What happens there, of course, is that they're so absorbed in the activity, this self-grasping is very much reduced. Even to the point where they often say, there was no sense of me. There was just the music playing. There was just the activity happening. And also they report peak performance, optimum performance at that time. Why? Because they're not so fighting against reality. They're more in harmony with reality. And this, of course, is only through the power of concentration. So through the power of concentration, the self-grasping is a little bit reduced. The better the concentration, the more we can sort of reduce it. But of course, that concentration is not eliminating self-grasping. It's just making it a little bit more dormant. If we want to get eliminate self-grasping, of course, we need to realize that, in fact, there is no independent me. We need the Vipassana practice. So with the Vipassana practice, and we come to realize there's no independent me, no independent world, then we'll come to be completely in harmony with reality. We'll come to realize that there is not one single boundary in the entire universe. Certainly there's no boundary between me and them. So by realizing this, by realizing emptiness directly, it's said that our love and compassion for others will literally explode to a level we never thought possible. Because now we have this sense of me here and them there. There appears to be a gap or distance, separateness. And so we, of course, we try to develop love and compassion as much as we can towards others, but there's still this sort of gap or separateness. When we come to realize emptiness,
will come to realize there's no separateness, there's no boundary between us and anyone else, and therefore we'll be able to develop boundless love and compassion towards others. So this is also then what's going to be a consequence of the Vipassana practice. It's really going to help the loving kindness and compassion practice really expand enormously. Okay, any questions? Otherwise, it's nearly lunchtime, so maybe a couple of questions to finish. Yeah?
Related to the suffering and its causes, I can see a lot of applications or its usefulness in dealing with mental suffering, mental afflictions. But what about gross physical suffering? You know, a pain pricks me, I feel the pain.
Right. So this is a good question. Yes, we can see it immediately on the mental side, but the physical side may be not so obvious. But here also, yes, if we have some physical stimulus and we have some discomfort, you know, maybe we twist our ankle or we have a migraine headache or something, then yes, there is a certain level of discomfort. But what is that discomfort? If we look at it in a purely objective sense, is it's simply a lot of sensations, isn't it? Intense sensations. And we tend to interpret those intense sensations as suffering or pain or suffering. And if we have a lot of self-grasping, then of course the same thing happens, is unpleasant, oh, I don't want that, go away. We instinctively have aversion. So if we have some unpleasant sensations through migraine or twisted ankle or whatever, then what happens on top of the intense sensations that are there is we interpret that as unpleasant, something we don't want, and then immediately aversion kicks in. You know, oh, go away. Oh, my headache, go away. And what we find, of course, is that the more the aversion, the more suffering. In fact, if we have very strong aversion, a huge percentage of our suffering we experience is self-induced, way above the initial discomfort level. So if we can realize emptiness, at least we can stop that magnification. Like an example, like a concrete example I can, from my own experience. Many years ago, I did a Goenka Vipassana retreat, a long time ago, one of the very first things I did. And just before that, I'd hurt my knee in a sporting accident. So I could sit maybe 20 minutes and then I'd have to move. But then halfway through the retreat, of course, there's these one-hour sessions of strong determination to you know, stop fidgeting, to sit still for an hour. So I was determined. You know, I was sitting still and after 20 minutes, pain. And, you know, it was getting more and more and more. And I was getting to the point where it was getting overwhelming. You know, I was like, oh, wow, that's too much. But at that time, the practice was to scan the body for sensations. And part of the instruction was, if you get to a point where there's some quite gross sensations, just stay there for a little while. So I was scanning down. I got to the knee, of course, very gross sensation. In fact, singular intense pain, overwhelming suffering. But then what happened was, if I stayed there and I had mindfulness, that singular intense pain started to break up into smaller bits of pain. And it kept breaking up until it was just thousands of intense sensations. And if I could stay there, and because that's all that was there, thousands of intense sensations, if I could stay there with mindfulness, it wasn't overwhelming. Okay, it was sensations and it was telling me to do something, but it wasn't overwhelming me. As soon as my mindfulness went, and soon as then my instinctive habit kicked in going, oh, that's pain, I don't want that, go away, as soon as my aversion kicked in, it was overwhelming. I couldn't stay there. So in that situation, I would say well over 90% of the suffering I experienced was self-induced through my aversion. More than 90, easy in that situation. So at least if we reduce self-grasping, we will avoid that situation of magnifying our unpleasant, if we have some unpleasant physical experience. In fact, often you'll find in the text, you know, it talks about someone who's had a direct realization of emptiness. You know, they can chop their arm off and have no suffering.
But, I mean, at our level, of course, we don't want to do that. But what I'm suggesting is that the more that we can work on this emptiness practice and reduce the self-grasping, and this has been my experience, the more we can stop magnifying suffering in physical unpleasant situations. That, I think, we can do. And I think we can sort of know that from our own experience. Like a classic example is, you know, often when someone's, like, let's say in a car accident, they're very badly hurt. I mean, they're crying out in pain. But how often do we see where maybe their partner's in the accident, they've smashed their leg badly, and normally they should be crying out in pain, but they look at their partner, who's maybe worse injured, and they don't even notice their pain, and they're just helping their partner. So what's happening there is that the self-grasping is very much, because they're so concerned about their partner. So, yes, there is some discomfort there, but they're not sort of crying out in pain. They're actually attending to their partner. And then only later, when they've done that, then they go, oh. And then of course, they often sort of have big problems. So this is a classic example, you know. And I think we can have that sort of experience ourselves, that if we really reduce self-grasping, then even physical discomfort, at least we won't magnify. At least we won't do that. Maybe we'll have some discomfort, but at least we won't unnecessarily induce a lot of suffering that we don't is not there. So we can do. I think we can manage that. Okay, I think that's lunchtime. Yeah, lunch is here. Okay, lunch is here. So let's have a break and come back at 2 o'clock. And at 2 o'clock, I'd like to go into looking at ourselves as a person, how to come to establish emptiness in terms of ourselves to help us to overcome self-grasping. So I'll describe the practice a bit, we'll do the practice, and then some feedback on that as well. Okay? So let's break for lunch.